Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're talking about how Democrats are trying to replicate Republican success in amplifying their political message across social media platforms, especially in how they use content creators and high-profile podcasters like Joe Rogan. Because that's where the prospective voters are. Influencing has grown into a $250 billion industry. And more than 70% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 say they follow an influencer on social media. Wired staff writer McKenna Kelly recently wrote about this effort in an article titled, "The Year Democrats Lost the Internet." Welcome back to All Sides, McKenna.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So why has it been so difficult for Democrats to craft a coherent message, especially in the internet?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look at 2020, the Democrats are really ahead at creating these vast networks of influencers that had a lot to do with the pandemic and being forced to do a lot of the electioneering work online. But come this year, it seemed as if they were targeting influencers, you know, and bringing influencers into the party who were already talking to the voters that were already interested in a Democratic message, who are already paying attention to the election. And when you look at what Trump did, talking to Joe Rogan, comedians like Theo Vaughn, all kinds of different folks online who maybe aren't focused on politics as much as they are comedy or lifestyle commentary or video games. What Trump's team was able to accomplish was bringing his message to people who actually, you know, probably weren't going out to vote and maybe got more encouraged and engaged because of these conversations.
So the Democrats were in an echo chamber, basically, but the Republicans were reaching out to celebrities. Is that a way to summarize it?
That's pretty much what happened. There was a group, Infogy, that did a study on a bunch of different people who were followers of accounts of. So if you look at Kamala Harris, she did that really big interview with Alex at Call Her Daddy, and then Joe Rogan. This group did a study of all the followers of those accounts, and a lot of the followers on Call Your Daddy were already like progressive artist types, according to the AI descriptions that came up in that study. Whereas for Joe Rogan, it was more like veterans and people like Christians and things like that, people who aren't inherently, the identity of their accounts wasn't political.
So I know Joe Rogan invited Kamala Harris to his studio, and then she countered with, "You come to me," and then they just never ended up meeting. So was that a mistake? Should the campaign have sent her there?
Sure. I mean, Joe Rogan, of course, would give her a giant audience. And it seems
a giant audience folks, different than her normal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Different than her normal audience. Exactly. But at the same time, it seems like, yes, her campaign did feel as if that was a missed opportunity and they may have needed to make time for it. But I just, for me personally, and like looking, you know, I look at this stuff every day and I covered it, you know, all election cycle. I don't think one interview like that would have saved her, right? Mm. There's a lot of different things there. And when I talked to Democrats, Democratic digital strategists, it wasn't necessarily just who she was talking to, but also the message that Democrats were delivering. And a lot of them were, you know, were saying that the message lacked, you know, a lot of what some folks, young folks especially, were hoping to hear from a politician, whether that was on the economy or other issues like that.
And you also wrote about Turning Point USA, which has produced some of the Republican Party's most influential voices, like Isabel Brown and Candace Owens. Has that been a successful formula for them? Can you tell me about what is Turning Point USA?
Yeah, Turning Point USA is this, it started out as a student conservative group run by Charlie Kirk. And what they did is they would, it's basically like a new college Republicans group that we all probably had when we were in school. Mm-hmm. And it did a lot of organizing. And by 2021, they were developing this contributor and ambassador program where they were bringing, you know, talent that they spotted online and training them on how to deliver a conservative Republican message online. In 2021, I went to their their America Fest, where they had a lot of trainings for these influencers. And a lot of these folks that you see who were really influential in this past election kind of came out of that group of people. I'm thinking of like DC Drano, a lot of influencers that we see interacting with Elon Musk and Trump online basically all the time.
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News. We are talking with Wired staff writer McKenna Kelly. So you wrote about the get on board philosophy that the right tries to keep, but that's unlike what the left has. So for the right, it's get on board, but for the left, the left loudly eats its own. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, it's so apparent in so many situations. I One of the biggest influencer moments this past election was at the Democratic National Convention, where hundreds of influencers were there at the United Center, hoping to, interview some lawmakers, some people, and then also create content supporting the Democratic Party. And surprisingly, they invited a creator by the name of Hassan Piker, who is very far, he's seen as a very far left figure, especially to the mainstream Democratic Party. And he was given so much room and time and a whole studio to set up his streaming equipment, because he has millions and millions of followers on Twitch, where he talks about politics for, I think it's like 12 hours a day at this point.
Whoa,
And
whoa,
he,
what?
yes. Yes.
Okay.
So he's
12
so
hours
I
a day is a lot of hours.
it is. I think his streams, he normally has his streams from like 2 to 2 Eastern
How many
time.
people watch this?
When the last couple times that I've watched the streams, it's around like 30,000 people
Okay.
concurrent.
Anyway, continue. I'm wrapping my head around that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, he's not like us where we have to prepare content. He kind of just shows up and like looks at the internet and comments on headlines.
Okay.
It's basically watching a man scroll through his Twitter feed.
Great.
But at the end, towards the end of the convention, he was asked to leave, is what he said, because of his he has said, and not the convention, I mean the party did not really confirm this, but in clips that he's posted online, he was asked to leave after talking to a bunch of folks who wanted a pro-Palestinian speaker. Someone from the Uncommitted Movement to chat, to speak before the DNC, and that did not happen. And around that time, he was asked to leave. So when we talk about the left eats its own, we're talking about a man who just like scrolls through his Twitter feed for 12 hours a day, and people eat and gobble it up and want to hear about politics and want to hear about liberal leftist messaging. But if someone steps out of line, maybe just a little bit from the mainstream message, they're cast aside.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like his audience is a very engaged audience. They care. They're passionate. So, this would be the type of people who presumably would vote it, right? But maybe if this rubbed them the wrong way, they either wrote in someone, did third party, or didn't vote, right? Because if they're left leaning, they're not going to vote for Trump, but then they're also probably annoyed and not going to vote for Harris. Do you think that happened?
Yeah, I think so. But I think Hassan also did end up encouraging his followers to vote for Kamala Harris near the end. I think what matters most about Hassan, where we talk about like the Democrats speaking to people in echo chambers this past election, was that Hassan also just gets a lot of trolls in his chat watching him. These are people who don't like him, don't like his message, who I think, he constantly engages with them. Like they'll, critique him on some, policy that he has or says. And then he'll come back at them and have like a real conversation with somebody in this chat. And I think those are kind of the conversations that, having someone like Hassan and like bringing Democratic messaging to and conveying it through this medium would really help. I want to talk about his audience real quickly, because even just like shortly after, weeks ago, he had Lina Khan, the FTC chair, on his live stream to talk about some new stuff that the agency was doing. And it was just crazy to like watch this chat full of like 40,000 people, I think, at the time, typing so like fast and calling this like FTC chairwoman based and saying she was so cool. Like
Wow.
something like that. Like there are communities that are so excited about these people and about these things and want to, provide these messages. It really is just taking the energy and doing it.
Did the FTC chair seem comfortable on this? I didn't see it. Was this a good thing?
Yeah, I thought that she came off really well. And I thought, I think this had something to do with like Fortnite refunds, like refunding like money in games. And so the audience specifically, it was tailored to the audience. And she's also like much younger than a lot of people in, the American bureaucratic system. And she came off really, really well, I thought.
Okay. Yeah. I was wondering, I was going to ask you if it was like a young staffer came and said, "Hey, I have an idea." And she actually said yes, right?
I think that's probably what it was. Mm-hmm. And there's other times where I've talked to people who are in like lower levels of government, who have told me that they've pitched these things, like working with creators on stuff. We've even seen, I think recently last year, Senator Elizabeth Warren was bringing creators in for briefings on legislation that she was doing on student debt relief. So it's not we're not just seeing this happening at like the highest electoral levels, but we're seeing it migrate its way down through this funnel to even like the granular legislative areas of our government.
So, yeah, this relates to, in the 2024 election cycle, traditional media outlets were often left out of the interviews, right? So Harris's deputy campaign manager said there was no value in sitting down with the New York Times or the Washington Post because those readers were already with Harris. So you wrote a December article that was called, "This Was the Year of the Influencer Political Takeover." So that's basically what you're saying is that influencers got the interviews instead of the traditional New York Times sit down or the sitting down with 60 Minutes, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, really, it seems like the only value that a lot of these conversations, a lot of these mainstream interviews had was that they were supplying content and video clips for these campaigns to post on their own TikTok channels, right? And for those to blow up and go viral online. I do think, that we have kind of gotten to this part where influencers have been so included in our election process and in our, media process when it comes to politics, that we might be leaning too far in that direction, where we see journalists who are trained reporters, people who have editors, people who have certain ethical guidelines that they follow, right, are getting cast out of this, getting cast out of being able to speak to people in these powerful positions. And I think that, over the next 4 years will probably become a point of reckoning. Maybe something bad will happen. I always imagine, I think to myself, what happens when one of these news influencers says something and they get sued for defamation from someone who is, extremely powerful, extremely wealthy. It is different when a mainstream media outlet does all of the ethical work that they need to do, all of the fact checking, posts something online, and then like the New York Times or whoever, and Trump sues them for defamation. That is a whole different process than an individual person who doesn't work for any specific media company. And
right.
I think,
and they don't have the media company's lawyers to help them either. So
exactly. Yeah. And I think that, if this is a trajectory that we continue to go on, we might just see more instances like that. And it might, we might shift back or find some kind of happy medium between traditional news reporting and content creation.
Are we in the position we're in right now because Trump's main way of communicating with anyone, including the media, starting back in 2016, was using Twitter? So I can remember that just changed the way news organizations, they learned that they had to take screenshots of everything he said because it could be deleted, stuff like that, instead of just, the traditional press release from the White House went out the window.
Right. I think the Trump tweets in 2016 coincided with a really important moment for media, period, where a lot of media outlets, we remember like the Facebook video. And so once Facebook video was found to be lying about their engagement and how many views that they were getting, news outlets everywhere in the U.S. started laying off tons of video journalists. We had, it's almost as if like the media had, the mainstream traditional press had put so much optimism in these platforms to, carry them, to help them reach audiences. And as soon as that wasn't profitable or didn't look great for Facebook, they pulled that away. So I think it's the same moment where we saw Trump's rise to power also coincided with this mainstream media's willingness to kind of like dump all of their resources in social media and become beholden to the algorithms that power these platforms.
And we're running out of time, but I do want to ask you about future regulation. You know, this year the Federal Elections Commission opted against requiring political influencers to disclose what political group or campaign paid for their accounts. But do you think that we're going to see in the future influencers be regulated or talk of that?
You know, transparency in this space is a complete mess. If you're trying to find any information on the Federal Election Commission fundraising or money or anything related to how campaigns are paying influencers, it's nearly impossible. There could be a management group paying the influencer, you know, being the third party here. Maybe they're getting paid, but they're being, instead of like being listed as an influencer, right? They're being listed as a consultant, a digital consultant, which is different in many ways. And yeah, I can see, you know, audiences are really demanding of the creators that they follow as well. And a lot of, I imagine that we'll see audiences, we've already kind of seen this, where we've seen people who follow influencers realizing that, oh my gosh, they're going to the White House all the time and getting these briefings. Maybe they're just in it for this influencer, and maybe they're just in it for this politician, and they don't necessarily believe in what they're saying. And I think before we see regulation, unfortunately, there probably will be community uprisings and people, these kind of like self-regulatory things happening in these spaces that we're already seeing now, where audiences are demanding that the creators that they follow are more transparent.
So the wild world of the internet that's been around
Yes.
forever just keeps getting wilder. Yeah. Okay. It's moving faster than we can. We'll stay on top of it. Thank you to Wired staff writer McKenna Kelly. Thanks for joining us today.
Of course.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how tech will change our lives in 2025. We'll have some predictions. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Jurevich. And this is a show where we discuss science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're going to talk about what technology is expected to evolve in 2025, delivering more fully on many of its earlier promises. Artificial intelligence continues to be at the center of many innovations and concerns. Joining us now from the Wall Street Journal is Joanna Stern, Senior Personal Technology Columnist. She recently co-wrote an article titled Tech That Will Change Your Life. Welcome back to All Sides, Joanna.
Thanks for having me.
So this is the annual write of yours trying to predict tech trends in the coming year. And looking at this year, artificial intelligence is going to be everywhere. AI agents who will help us with tasks, AI forecasts, and more. But before we get to the AI, which I want to get to, we have to start with some different innovations, the news with TikTok. Will TikTok be with us for 2025?
I believe, looking at my crystal ball, TikTok will be with us in some shape or form. How TikTok stays with us is the big question. There's basically three routes. This Friday, the Supreme Court is going to start to hear arguments about keeping TikTok within the US. And just to back up for a second, the US ban is supposed to begin on January 19th. And that means that the company would have to shed its US, or sorry, shed its Chinese ownership. So first option, the Supreme Court overrules this. They say it does, you know, it violates the First Amendment, and okay, TikTok lives. That's option one. Option two is that the Trump administration gets in there. The administration can't unilaterally wipe away this act of Congress, but they can determine if the site is no longer under Chinese control or is less of a Chinese or a threat from China. So that would be option two. And then option three is that ByteDance finally just decides we're going to sell this thing. It's not really worth it to us. And I would say option three is unlikely at this point, but still on the table.
So TikTok, you said TikTok of some form or another will be with us in 2025. Can you really ever get rid of an app? I mean, it can it just like change its name, change its location?
Right. I mean, sure, there's option four, which is that it just get the ban happens, right? Mm-hmm. And then we have a lot of people trying to scramble to figure out, can we still use TikTok in some shape or form here? If it's an app that's old on people's devices, if they're using VPNs, other types of things. We have never really had in this country a ban of that kind of sort. It would be completely unprecedented. The app stores would certainly have to comply. We'd have the operating system. So many parts of it would have to really come together for that ban to really stick. Looking at my crystal ball, I don't think we're going to get there. We have these other options. I don't think ByteDance wants to get there. But again, well, you know, I guess the clock is, yeah.
Tick-tocking, right? I got your pun. I'm with you. But Pew Research shows that from last month that public support of this ban has eroded. I mean, it seemed like everyone was all up in arms about TikTok, and now everyone's just like, eh.
I think there's been a lot of people of the content creators on TikTok that have made quite loud about what damage this would do to their businesses, what damage this would do to free speech in this country. So there has been a lot of support for those creators and for the platform. I think also there's been this thought that this has been going on now for many years. We've just been hearing about TikTok as this pawn between these two countries, and that now we're finally going to get some resolution. And I don't think that many people really believe it will get fully banned, as if we will never be able to scroll through TikTok videos again.
Right. Or, you know, like a different generation does see the TikTok videos 3 weeks later on Instagram or Facebook, right?
Again, likely scenario.
Yeah. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about technology for the new year with Wall Street Journal's Joanna Stern, senior personal technology columnist. So let's get to AI. AI is the center of a lot of innovations, and there's a rise of the so-called AI agent. It's being hailed as this agenting era. So AI agents will increasingly help us with everyday tasks. What are you looking at in 2025 for more AI?
So the agents is such a big thing. I think like we can absolutely, I will say with 100% certainty, we will be hearing about AI agents. Will AI agents make a big difference in our personal lives this year? That is what we're not sure of. But what I can tell you is going to happen is you're going to have all these big tech companies, all these big AI companies, Google, OpenAI, Meta, et cetera, talking about how agents and what these agents, why they're different than what we've had with chatbots, is that they can go out and do things for us. Mm. Right now, generative AI has been a lot about generating text, generating images, video. You haven't been able to sort of say to one of these chatbots, hey, go book my travel to Bora Bora, book my hotel, book my flights, make sure that I'm seated in this row, giving a bunch of prompts and ideas to the bots or the agents and having it go do it. And so we're going to start to see these companies take steps towards that kind of functionality this year. Will we all be able to do that? Will we be able to trust that? That's what I'm excited to test, but we don't know yet.
And there's been a lot. I mean, you can't turn on any TV channel or streaming channel without seeing an ad for Google's new Gemini. So this is one of the examples. I mean, the ads make it look very, very streamless, like you're having a conversation, right?
And this is what we're going to see, I think, in another big way this year, is all of these companies, whether you're using Google products or Microsoft products or Apple products or Meta products, that they're going to just be pushing those AI products and those tools into what you currently use. And so if you're a Google user, you're a Gmail user, you use Google to search the web, you already know that you're getting an AI summary. If you're using Gmail, you're already getting that AI summary of your email, and then it's giving you some, between, I think, us, you know, some pretty poor responses to write back. I mean, sometimes I'm like, I'm writing to my mom. Why would I write this very professional email back to her? But
It also picks 12 words when one would do often. I feel like it like
so
overwrites.
Right. And I've signed my name 3 times in the previous chain. So I'm pretty sure I don't need to keep writing sincerely, Joanna. And I don't think I've ever written sincerely. So, but what we are absolutely going to see more of these tools being pushed. And in some places, we're going to want to use them. But in other places, they're just going to continue to be there. And these companies are going to continue to want us to use them by putting them in front of us in these different interfaces.
When I think of the AI agents, it makes me think, robots, I guess. did you see the movie Wild Robot? I don't know if you saw that or if you've read the book.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. Well, yes.
It looks very cute. I want to watch it. It's on the list.
Yes. So, my son loved the movie and is reading the books, and I feel like it's the future. This robot can do anything and everything. Right.
Okay. Yeah. I just watched WALL-E with my son, so yeah. Hopefully it's a little bit different in the vision of the future.
Yeah. Well, this one eventually develops feelings, so there's same as WALL-E, right? It's
the same as WALL-E.
Yeah. Well, another AI gadget that's going to be coming out. Apple has a 6-inch smart home display, so it's kind of like an iPad for your wall. Are we going to have more and more of this?
Yeah. This is another trend that around AI where I think we're going to see companies trying to push AI into some of the places that haven't, some of the categories, the product or gadget categories that haven't yet sort of been supercharged, one of them being the smart home. And yes, there is reports that Apple is working on a 6-inch smart home display. It would be like an iPad for your kitchen or your living room wall, big emphasis on Siri. And as we've known, Siri has not been sort of the AI agent or AI solution we have all dreamed of.
She can be very really, choppy, no offense to her, but she does not seem as seamless as Gemini.
Yes. not as savvy, but Apple has told me in interviews they are working on that. They are going to make big strides in Siri in the next number of years. But I think one of the places they see that is in the home, mm-hmm. being able to, and I don't want to say it on air because maybe I'll start triggering people's phones as Siri, but asking Siri to do various things around, I just did it to my own.
Right. I'm hiding mine. Opening, over, yeah. Good.
Doing various things in the house and being able to tie that all together. So if the lights can talk to the lock, and if you say good night, it all kind of works together. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of challenges in the smart home space, and I think this is an opportunity for Apple to say we can use our platform, the security and privacy, and the fact that hey, you've already got iPhones, you've got iPads, why don't you let us control some more of the home?
Another thing you wrote about is these giant energy suckers, all of these data centers, hundreds of data centers, including Central Ohio has a lot of them. We're home to more than 100 data centers, including Amazon, Facebook, Google, but they just use so much energy. Are they working on trying to be better neighbors? Because these huge centers are driving up local electricity rates. There are some innovative ways of trying to help with that.
Well, this is a huge focus, again, on AI, because as AI increases, as these models demand more power, so do the needs for these data centers. And so most of these companies, the big companies, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, et cetera, are all investing in nuclear power. And so we're hoping to hear more progress on that in the next year. Mm-hmm. They're looking at other sort of cleaner energy sources, but it is without a doubt what is going to happen is that you're going to see all of the big tech players invest in more and more data centers, certainly also ways to make that cleaner sources of energy and hopefully make the prices of that go down.
There's that company investing in America's Pine Belt. They want to fuel it by burning wood chips. What's that?
It's true. It's a company called Drax, and they're hoping to build a power plant in the Pine Belt, mm-hmm. and using burning wood chips to power and with the emissions are pumped underground, so there's less pollution. I can't say that one's going to go hugely big in 2025, mm-hmm. but it's really nice to see alternative sources here and them getting also a lot of investment.
You also, in your article, wrote about weather apps. We just had some big winter weather, but the weather forecasting has been very dicey. It's hit and miss. According to NOAA, a typical 10-day forecast is accurate only half the time, right? So how will technology improve? What's your prediction for 2025? Are we going to get better at predicting the weather?
Yeah, I literally looked out the window yesterday, and it's snowing in New York City, and yet my app says it's not snowing and that it's not going to snow today. And I looked out the window and I said, where is that prediction? Why has that prediction not come true in the last 6 days or 7 days of this year? But what Google's DeepMind is said to be working on is a new model called GenCast, which can accurately forecast up to 15 days in advance, which is better than current predictions.
That's a lot of days, though, man. Okay.
It's a lot of days. And I mean, as we know, so, but they're saying, look, our long-term forecasts will get better, but also hopefully those short-term forecasts will get better too. And they've done this by really using lots of data, looking at data for years and years and years of model weather predictions, hoping that this will help the other humans who are helping predict the forecast together predict whether that actually is what we see.
Maybe my phone just needs to look out the window. Is that what has to happen?
Literally, Siri, just look out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And you also wrote about electric vehicles. So the Trump administration plans to roll back federal subsidies for EVs, and then there's plans for tariffs. What are you thinking about what's going to happen with electric vehicles in 2025?
So there's a big question mark on EVs, and this is a space I really have liked watching over the last couple of years. There's been a lot of incentive from the federal government to make it easier on consumers to buy these EVs with subsidies, especially, and those have been great for leasing an EV. I've done that myself. My Ford Mustang Mach-E is leased, and I got subsidies, and you know, that definitely helped me and encouraged me to get that car. Seems like that is a lot of that is going to go away, certainly under the Trump administration and Elon Musk, who's been guiding President Trump on some of this, is not been in favor of some of these subsidies. That said, there is more happening on the EV side to make the costs of these cars come down, the batteries come down. And that is what a lot of these manufacturers have been targeting. Whether that happens this year or over the next couple of years, we'll see. And then also big question marks are sort of around the EV charging infrastructure that has been, I wouldn't say has taken off under the Biden administration, but has certainly been started under the Biden administration. Will we see that continue? Will we see that infrastructure that's actually there for people who do have these cars?
And how much will depend on what Elon Musk tells Trump, right?
Certainly. And look, like, you know, there's been big success in hybrids. Mm-hmm. That's going to continue to happen. Tesla, all these other companies are here to play. They seem to want to continue to, with this electrification, just is really a question, I think, of the combination of what the federal government will do to spur that.
Related to cars, in some cities, you can hail self-driving taxis. You can use the Uber app to hail them. What do you see for 2025 in more self-driving taxi services?
Yeah, I think it's funny. We've been doing this prediction stuff for over 10 years now. And in 2017, I wrote that it was going to be the year you'd ride in a self-driving car.
Oh, nope.
I was a little bit off. But this is the year. I'm telling you. If you visit a city, if you visit Los Angeles, San Francisco, Atlanta, Austin, so many more of these cities are becoming homes to Waymo. Waymo is Alphabet's self-driving car division. And I went in my first Waymos in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, and I will tell you, you've got to experience it. You've just got to go try it out. It is very simple to do. But yes, in some cities, in Atlanta and Austin, you're going to be able to hail these Waymos through the Uber app. And so you'll go to the Uber app, you'll see an option to get a Waymo, a self-driving car. When I say self-driving, I mean there's no human behind the wheel. There's no human in the front seat. There's no human in the passenger seat. There's just no human.
Oh, and that makes me itchy.
It is a trip, and you will be nervous for the first, you know, few minutes, and then you will get over it. I promise you.
Okay.
And yeah, sure. There's been some reports right now about, you know, people getting stuck in some of these cars or them not pulling over at the right places. But overwhelmingly, the data is showing that these are quite safe drivers. They are not really yet on highways, so they're really on local roads in these cities. But I'm telling you, you're going to try it. You're going to try it this year, and you're going to like it, Amy. You'll be like, oh.
You were a few years off on the self-driving taxis in your prediction. What year is it that you told me, or, well, a previous host of this show, that I would be wearing, you know, virtual reality glasses all the time in my home? Is that so we're still not doing that?
That definitely sounds like a thing I said to you. Yeah. I mean, you should just not trust anything I've said. No, look, I mean, we're going to get
Why aren't we all wearing Google glasses by now?
If we're ever all going to wear Google glasses, but we're all going to get to a place where we may want to wear the glasses. And I think, you know, look, Meta has done a really interesting. Well, they've done a really good job with their Ray-Ban glasses. These are glasses that don't have a screen. If you've tried them, I don't know, but I use them all the time. They have a camera built in. So you kind of go hands-free to record or take photos, and you can also ask Meta AI questions. So it's all built into the glasses, and they're lower price. They're $200, $300. It's really an ability to put down your phone mm-hmm. and just see the world and take some photos through your glasses. That's a step. This coming year, Meta said they're going to be doing much more. Mark Zuckerberg even confirmed one of my scoops, which is that they're working on these glasses that have a heads-up display, a small display in there. They also last year showed a really big bet on what's coming in the future with a real display, color, really the kind of virtual reality experience or the mixed reality experience you've only been able to get with big headsets, but in smaller glasses. So this is all coming, but in this next year, we will absolutely see more from Meta in this space.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, but I will, if I find myself in Austin or I can't remember what other cities you said, maybe I'll try it's Waymo, right? I'm sorry. How do you say it?
Waymo. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Waymo. You're good. You're good.
Yeah. So if I find myself there, maybe I will. Maybe you've talked me into it. But thank you to Joanna Stern, senior personal technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us.
See you in a Waymo.
Coming up with what's new at the Consumer Electronics Show, that is when All Sides Tech Tuesday continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. Technology is always improving, and as advancements are made over time, the public gains access to new and transformative devices. The Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas showcases some of these devices that will be coming to the market soon. Joining me to discuss some new products unveiled this year is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor at Commerce for Commerce at CNET. Russell, welcome back to All Sides.
Thank you.
So one product at the Consumer Electronics Show this year is a robot vacuum. So it has a mechanical arm to move objects. Can you tell me about this robot vacuum? Where is it putting my objects?
The absolute number one problem with every robot vacuum is if you have children or pets, that, you know, you cannot guarantee that your floors are going to be completely spotless at the end of the night. So a lot of people will be told to like set them to clean overnight so that you don't have to worry about it. You can, you know, it'll vacuum everything when it's asleep. But if you've ever seen it, one of these robot vacuums run over a cable or halfway chew through a kid's toy, you know that it's not a good time. This robot is designed, as you said, with a mechanical arm that comes out when it detects something with the cameras that are built on it that is not supposed to be there. And you can actually choose using the app that it comes with where those things get put. So you can designate a basket in a specific corner of the room or, you know, just a pile that you want to put somewhere, and anything that it, you know, detects that it can pick up, it will pick up and bring over to that place and put it down and then continue its cleaning cycle.
Wow. So how heavy of an object can it pick up? Can it pick up a shoe or what is it picking up?
Currently, it's limited to things that are under 2 pounds. Most kids' toys and socks and you know, stuff like that. It's not gonna be lifting up your end table anytime soon to clean underneath of it. But this is a pretty significant step forward as far as what these cleaning robots essentially are capable of.
Yeah, I find that my robot vacuum tends to just get stuck. I mean, I have an older one that did not do a good job mapping my house. So it just gets stuck and finds itself on a ledge and calls distress mode all the time.
Yeah, there are a lot of these out there now, and they vary pretty wildly as far as capability and price. And that is a big kind of stall point for some of these. A lot of these robot vacuums, whether they're made by RoboRock like this one is, or a couple of the other ones, They can get up above $1,500 in price, and some of them include like mopping features and things like that. This is pretty much a standard vacuum. There's not a lot of extra features because that robot arm takes up, you know, a lot of space on the machine. And we don't have exact pricing yet, but this is looking like it'll probably start at around $2,000.
$2,000. Okay. So when will it be available to the public?
They're currently saying that this is something we'll see by the summer. But the fun thing about CES is that nothing is ever guaranteed as far as a release date. So I try not to give hard dates for any of that stuff.
Right. Lots of oohs and ahs, but not a bunch of whens. Is that what?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Another potentially transformative product seen at CES is Samsung's, is it Bali? Or Bali.
It is Bali. B-A-L-L-I-E. And
a home robot that was unveiled. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so this is actually a really good example of how long it can take something that is announced at CES to come to market, because Bali was originally shown by Samsung and at CES in 2020, where it had a couple of features that allowed it to roll around the house and follow you and basically act like a smart speaker, and its ability to listen to you and play music and, you know, kind of give you information. And last year, it was announced that this was something that they intended to bring to market to make it so that, you know, people could actually purchase this thing and not just a tech demonstration. And what they had added to it was a projector, so that if you asked for additional information or you wanted to, you know, watch a quick YouTube video or something like that, Bali would actually find a spot on your walls or on the ground. And actually project an image for you to interact with or for you to watch. So you could, you know, say, hey, I want to see that news clip that just came across as far as like an important feed that you had decided, and it would pick a spot on the wall automatically and project it onto that wall. Or if there were things that it needed feedback from you from and you didn't want to speak, it would actually project yes and no on the floor, and you could use your foot to just tap in one of the big buttons that it projected on the ground in order to interact with this robot.
Really? Okay. So can you, I did not Google what it looks like. What does it look like? Wall-E from Pixar? What does it look like?
So it's not terribly different from something that you would expect to see in Wall-E. The Samsung Bali is a great big yellow ball. It's got four wheels on it. It doesn't actually roll around like BB-8 from Star Wars, but it does kind of look like that a little bit, only bright yellow with some black accents. But yeah, this is Samsung's, you know, home robotics project that has been in the works for at least 5 years now. And the promise that they made at this event is that it will actually ship at some point in 2025.
Okay, so but having a home robot like this, is this just so you're not on your phone all the time? So if you're like emptying the dishwasher and you're like, and you can tell the robot, hey, look this up for me, and it will, or like, yeah?
Yeah, the goal seems to be to have something similar to, you know, the smart home products that are available from Amazon and from Google and from Apple, but in this form of a robot that follows you around. So instead of having a dedicated thing that gets plugged in somewhere in the house that you have to be within voice range to understand, that this thing would just be nearby when you needed to interact with it somehow, and would just be there near you, almost like a weird robot pet.
Okay, so yes, so like how a dog follows you around the house, but a cat ignores you. So is that the difference?
That's exactly right. And, you know, because this thing is a big round ball, it's obviously not going to be ideal if you have a lot of steps in your house.
Oh, yeah. You'd have to pick it up and take it with you like a little baby.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I don't know if Samsung's going to release like a harness strap for it or something so that you can carry it around conveniently. But yeah, this is something that would likely exist on the first floor of a house and would just be there for, you know, when it detected a human being nearby.
So if you're having a dance party in the kitchen and it's playing music, it'll follow you and you can continue your dance party into the dining room.
That's the general idea. Yeah, there's speakers built into it to go with the projector. So it is supposed to be this kind of combination help assistant and entertainment machine.
Okay. Have you seen I asked the last guest this. Have you seen the new movie Wild Robot or read the book?
I have, in fact, read and watched Wild Robot, yeah.
Is this our first version of Into Before It Can Be Like Roz?
That is exactly right. Yeah, this is a very similar concept in that it's, you know, this is designed to be this kind of helpful service thing that comes around. It's not terribly different in concept from Amazon's Astro robot that has not been terribly successful over the last couple of years. But the idea that you have this kind of personal robot that is just sort of there when you need it is the kind of genre, I guess, that this kind of robot is going to fit into for a little while.
All right. Well, once it has feelings, you can we'll report back on that.
It just needs to sit still for a while and learn the language of the forest, and then I think it'll be much yes. more useful.
So it let your robot outside, and it'll discover. Okay. Another thing that was revealed is from the beverage company Rome. They announced their soda top, which can be used to carbonate beverages in individual water bottles. So this is basically like, is it a smaller version than what we know as the soda stream?
Yeah, more or less. This is something that you can attach to the top of an existing hydro flask or similar bottle. And, you know, you put, you know, kind of cold water in there, you know, or room temperature water in there. This is a tiny CO2 cartridge that goes into this cap and you push down on it and it will fizz the water that's there, just like a soda stream would. It's designed for these kind of individual use cases where you can have, you know, sparkling water wherever you are instead of having to go and buy a separate bottle of it.
Okay. And is this something that's available now, or is it one of those coming soon?
There are versions of this that are going to be available later this month. And then the company has promised in the future to release different cartridges that will go onto these hydro flasks where the CO2 inside will actually be flavored. So you'll be able to add flavoring in addition to the sparkling effect to whatever water you have put in there.
Is it reasonably priced?
We haven't been given prices on many of the cartridges yet. We know that the actual like top part is going to be about $50. And then replacing the CO2 cartridges isn't expected to be terribly expensive, but you're going to end up, you know, having that, that repeat expense anytime you want to refill the inflatable part of your bottle.
All right. So that seems reasonably priced for accessibility for people who like their spicy water, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, when you think about kind of the cost over time when it comes to having to go into a store and buy either, you know, like a Liquid Death or a Perrier or something like that, then, you know, this will definitely end up being less expensive over time.
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we're talking with Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, and switching gears a little bit from the Consumer Electronics Show to net neutrality. That has been in the news very recently this week. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals recently struck down the Biden administration's net neutrality policy. That was a reinstatement of a policy from Obama. And this marks it's a major victory for Republicans in their effort to roll back regulations in a number of private sector industries. So can you tell me about what does net neutrality do and what could happen to the internet without it?
Sure. Yeah. So at its core, the concept behind net neutrality is to allow the internet to be a service that is universally available, that is, you know, kind of available at the same level of quality and expense to as many people as possible, that there aren't kind of different tiers of service, that you're only able to access certain websites if you pay a certain tier, that sort of thing. Like paying for the internet should mean that you have access to its entirety and not just kind of specific versions of it. And that is something that has been batted back and forth in courts and through different political administrations over the last 15 years. There have been some pretty staggering defeats and some pretty interesting wins when it comes to how this is enforced across a bunch of different spaces. You know, it had already been widely expected that with the next administration that net neutrality was going to be, you know, kind of removed anyway, because there had already been several comments about, you know, that not being a priority for the next administration. But this court case makes it very clear that even were there to be a Democratic group to come in after the next administration, that setting this up in a way that would be effective for consumers is going to be very difficult moving forward.
I mean, is the internet a utility? Should it be regulated like water and sewer and electricity?
I mean, we've reached a point where it is nearly impossible to do things like enter the job market, or, you know, there's many different forms of education, especially now that we are, I'm actually sitting in Maryland where we just got 11 inches of snow overnight. And there's a school day today where a lot of kids are attending school from home instead of having a snow day. That's only possible if you are paying for internet at home. And if your internet service is prohibitively expensive because, you know, you live in a poverty area, or you're, you know, just kind of struggling for one reason or another, that this is not something that is available to you in the same way that a utility would be available to you. And that is something that over the next 4 years, it is entirely likely that we will see companies like Comcast and you know, some of the other utility style providers for these internet services start to tier those subscriptions so that you have, you know, kind of a basic internet that allows you access to, you know, kind of Facebook and YouTube and things like that, and then a more advanced version of the internet that gives you access to more of the world around you. And that could be really detrimental, especially in educational environments.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you for explaining net neutrality, which is hard for me to say for some reason. I don't know that word, net neutrality.
It's never easy.
Regulating the internet, how about that?
That's right.
That was Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you, Russell, for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. That was Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Rocky Mountain spotted fever is the deadliest